whatever you try out, well, you can make an educated guess how well it works. But in the end, you have to try it out to see if it works. And that's where you need to limit the amount of investment you make into one particular case until you prove that it works.
Hello and welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. I'm Carsten Bange, founder and CEO of Bark, and my guest today is Tobias Zwingmann. He's a well-known author, speaker, researcher, and consultant for implementing AI. And he's a new Bark fellow. So we have made him part of our team, and you can also access his knowledge and his support through Bark now. We talk about his new book, The Profitable AI Advantage, and obviously it's about one of the hottest topics of the day, that is, how can AI deliver ROI, return on investment? He has some frameworks and patterns for us to ensure that companies, first of all, select the right use cases, and he calls that pattern the 10K threshold, to make sure that you select the right uses that can actually deliver an ROI and you think about it upfront. Secondly, if you think about the implementation, what AI scenarios and what AI technology is available, it's also important to select the right one because he says often investment is too high to deliver ROI in AI projects. And all this and much more valuable advice you will hear in this episode. Enjoy it. Hi, Tobias.
Hi, Carsten. Hi.
Hey, great to have you back on the Data Culture Podcast. And Tobias, there's a great opportunity to have you back because you wrote this wonderful book, The Profitable AI Advantage. And I thought it would be a great opportunity to talk a little bit about the content. But before we do that, tell us, why did you write this book? Why another book on AI? I think there are a few already on the market.
Oh, yeah. It's actually a funny story. I think in the preface, I wrote something like, the world does not need another AI book because there's so many out there. And funnily, actually, I didn't really sit down to write a book because some of you might know, like, I've been writing a newsletter now for 2 years, I think even more than 2 years, every week. And so, like, this book just kind of happened. And as I was writing this newsletter every week, I, like, came to the realization that the topics I was covering kind of, like, shifted more from, like, hands-on data analytics things to, oh, you know, Gen AI happened, so this is Gen AI, to what do we do with it? And then finally, how do we actually turn it into solutions that are actually profitable? When Peck, the publisher, reached out to me about like 1 year ago, it was clear that we wanted to turn that into a book. But to be honest, this whole like profitability angle really developed during the course of writing the book. And this was also why, like, for me, it was so important to have the word profitable AI in there, because this is what I see right now. Like, AI is still relevant and lots of companies are doing it and doing experimentations and so on. But those who have actually done something are now at the stage of, you know, wondering, how can we turn this into something that we can measure and, like, you know, improves our business really?
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. As a new Bark fellow, you also attended our last Data and AI Summit, and that was a big topic there. And also your presentation was very received on exactly this topic, yeah, ROI of AI. And also at the Data Festival, we had many discussions, presentations around the topic that now it's really time to show value, that data and AI teams have to do that, especially in economic harder times, yeah, where there's a lot of pressure on costs overall in organizations. And AI, my impression is AI had a little bit of a special status, yeah, that it was seen you have to do it. And when ChatGPT came out, yeah, it was just a hype and basically you couldn't avoid it as an enterprise and also as a manager in an enterprise. So you had to do something. And I think that has changed. Yeah. Now the hype is over. And now AI, yeah, if it doesn't deliver, it's actually also becoming or getting under pressure. And we even see some teams getting reduced in size, yeah, because basically there's not so much money left. Is that also something you are observing?
Yeah, I mean, not on the reduction side, like, but the companies that I work with are lost. Like, what should be the next step? So, like, there are two, like, two very common patterns. The first pattern is their companies are being like swamped with potential AI opportunities. So they have been looking for internal use cases. Like they have a list of like 50, 100 plus use cases like in their drawer in some Excel sheet or on some PowerPoint. And the question is, okay, what to do next? Because it's very hard to prioritize these cases because on paper, they all seem more or less like interesting or lucrative, but it's very hard to assess actually what is the feasibility of those and also what are the associated costs of those use cases. So that's part number one. And the other part is companies that are already invested in AI, like by either like, you know, having built a team or having built infrastructure or having purchased a bunch of Copilot licenses and are now wondering, okay, how do we turn that into something that we can measure? Because I feel that a lot of companies were kind of just relying that just by enabling this technology or purchasing the licenses, that value creation will kind of just happen, right? So if everyone now has Copilot, then you know we'll all be much faster at work. But it's not as straightforward as that. And you know, I come in on either of both sides to either figure out, okay, what could be like, how can we turn this backlog of use cases into a nice roadmap that has like a direct path to profitability, or to take those initiatives that have already been taking place and see how can we like, you know, rephrase or reformulate that in a way that, you know, it has more measurable return, or maybe sometimes it doesn't, and then you know, you have to pivot or just live with it. Especially with Copilot, it's very hard to like put a number against these augmented use cases. It's very hard to do that.
Yeah, isn't that true even generally in terms of Gen AI, often used as more like an infrastructure in an organization, so basically made available for everyone, and then often a lot of the cases are more personal productivity, I would call them. Yeah, so I increase my personal productivity. Isn't it the case that the measurable impact of the Gen AI investments in general are very hard to measure?
I would say it depends. So what I've seen is, well, not what I have seen, but what I do right now is that I like have these initiatives kind of like bucketized or organized in two different tracks. The first one is, as you say, those personal productivity AI use cases. So the Copilots and ChatGPTs and Co's. This is more about like upskilling and enablement and getting people work with these assistants. The other bucket is what I call these engineered AI use cases. And these are also the ones that I describe more in my book, where you have to build something in order to get a like highly likely outcome. I give you an example. So one of this is, for example, that customer support chatbot. So let's say you want to reduce the first level support that is being done for your customers. So you could either give your people ChatGPT or Copilot to answer those queries faster. That would be bucket one. Or bucket two would be to you put a customer facing chatbot solution outside with all the monitoring, governance, and everything that is needed to measure how many less emails are actually coming in during peak times. And for me, like these are two separate things, because the second one you can clearly measure, like, you know, what was the investment and, you know, how many less emails are you getting? But secondly, the like, you know, the first bucket, you can't really measure that. It's very hard to say, oh, yeah, like, you know, we are now doing more throughput, or we're now doing, you know, because you're not laying anyone off just because they work faster now, right? And also you don't necessarily have higher throughput because maybe the amount of, you know, incoming calls that you get or customer inquiries is still the same. So this is very hard to measure. But the second one is actually pretty good to measure. So that's one example where I also try to make sure that the way of measuring this ROI has to be like defined in the right way up front. Because if you try to measure those value, like monetary gains with a productivity bucket, that won't work. On the other hand side, if you don't have measurable financial goals to these engineered cases, then this will just be a cost sink. So like having this set up right up front, I think this is very important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Before we drill into that in a little bit more detail, let's start at the beginning. I think you mentioned something super interesting that you said, okay, companies are lost and often they have too many use cases. A few years back, it was often too few, yeah, but now it's too many. And so how can companies transform, change this backlog of use cases to an actual roadmap?
So yeah, multiple steps. Of course, they're all described in the book. But the most important step that I use is something that I call the 10K framework. And the 10K framework, or the 10K threshold, essentially means to, before you do, as an organization, before you do anything with AI or, you know, any other initiative whatsoever, you have to like define what is the like the minimal reward you want to see in order to actually change some things. Because if you like whatever you do, if you change things, it will always cost you some, you know, time, energy, and effort up front. So what do you want to get in return at a minimum level? And I like to quantify that in multiples of 10K, where 10K approximately, 10K per month approximately is like one full-time equivalent, like, you know, plus minus, but that's roughly how that translates to. And you can start from there, you know, should that be the minimum value that you want to get out of a new initiative, like one FTE equivalent, or you could also like, you know, put that in monetary terms, 10K per month. Or do you want to be less ambitious, a little bit less ambitious, maybe 10K per quarter or 10K per year, which would be like a very low impact, but still you could measure it. Or do you want to be even more aggressive? Let's say you're a big corporation and like, you know, 10K per month is like, you know, hardly noticeable for you. So then you would need to like dial or tune more to 10K per week or 10K per day. And after you have that initial alignment, which I think is really, really important, because like figuring out which use cases to do is always like a team effort. Like you have to like, you know, talk to people, figure out, okay, who's in charge for what. And you have to make sure that all share a very similar like ambition level. That's what I call it. Not really a goal, because everyone has can have different goals, but, you know, all should have a very similar ambition level. Kind of like being sure of what is the minimal hurdle you want to jump over. Because that makes a lot of things much easier. Otherwise, you will like end up finding yourself in a project 6 months in and finding out that some people just wanted to, you know, break even and other ones wanted to have the next big moonshot. And you want to avoid these cases because once you have a clear common baseline of what you want to achieve at a minimum, it's much easier to go through your list of use cases and say, oh yeah, is this one above that? And if so, is it multiple times above that or is it below that? That's much faster and much easier in my experience compared to figuring out exactly what is the value of each use case. It's much easier to just figure out, okay, is that one over the threshold? Yes or no? And that will pretty quickly get rid of a lot of cases. Yeah.
Okay. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's also my experience. Yeah. It's super hard to, especially upfront, yeah, when you don't really know how that will turn out, the use case. So you can obviously only have a guess. Yeah. But a rough guess already tells you, let's say, at least the ballpark. So where are we here? Yeah, are we talking about $1,000 a day or a month or a year? And that's, I think that's very valuable. And it also circumvents a little bit the problem that you cannot really calculate anything at that point of time. Yeah, so all you have is like an educated guess. But I like the idea of thinking about a threshold. I think that is like a new idea here in this discussion, that you rather think about, okay, do we believe that we can make it or not? Is that a roughly good understanding?
Yeah, absolutely. And for the last client that I worked with, they actually modified this a little bit because, you know, they didn't felt so comfortable like putting that exact number on there, but we translated that into hours. So what we did was we took their whole use case backlog and eliminated all problems that were like that had an impact less than 1,000 hours per year. Mm-hmm. So the 1,000 hour per year threshold, you know, which translates to, you know, 20 hours per week, more or less. You know, that gave everyone really a good understanding of, you know, looking at a problem saying, oh, do we actually spend 1,000 hours or 20 hours per week on that problem? And for a lot of domain experts, they are like it's very easy for them to say yes or no, or to say, oh, well, maybe with some goodwill, right? But we want to identify those cases that are clearly above those 1,000 hour cases. And sometimes we need to like put more cases together or figure out like one particular case was there this whole like, you know, intake and triage thing to, you know, classify incoming emails and documents and sorting all these things where we realized, okay, one individual unit will not get us above that threshold. But if we combine 5 or 6, 7 units together, then we're definitely above that threshold. And that also helped with like figuring out what is the right like organizational structure for these use cases to make sure we're not implementing like a triage system for this inbox and for that inbox and for that inbox, but building one system that has a potential to also enable other use cases that are very, very similar to that one. So that's how we used it there, like with 1,000 hours per year, which I found very effective. That was their idea, by the way.
No, but a good idea, because it makes it even more tangible. Yeah, so that's something, okay, that's what I can think about. How big is the problem? I think that's a good starting point. Talking about patterns, now we talk about use cases. And do you see any pattern in successful use cases where there is a lot of ROI? Is it like more in the core processes of an enterprise where the true differentiators are, or rather not because they're already optimized? So is it rather in the supporting cases, processes? Or is it often more in the customer-facing ones? Is there any pattern, or are they just all over the board?
Well, there are patterns. Like I already mentioned, like customer support. The other big pattern is marketing. The other big pattern is document value extraction. But the problem is, like, these patterns are just so big that a lot of organizations can't really translate that in concrete actual solutions. So I would say, yes, there are patterns, like from the use case side, but on the actual level of execution, like, it gets really, really granular and really, really, like, custom. And in order to kind of, like, avoid that, I try to stay as long as possible in this, like, what I call augmented use case zone, where we can accept an 80% solution that we can set up in maybe, like, you know, 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 8 weeks, where people are still, like, in the loop and, you know, try to double-check things or, like, work with things. They don't have a perfect solution. It's also not the perfect value capture of the use case, but it gets them, like, the first way there, or it gets them actually, like, exposed to the, like, to the AI and to how the solution works. And this is a pattern that I can see really, really frequently. So if you try to build that, like, highly integrated, highly automated solution where, you know, agents are running on everything and doing everything, if you start there, you will spend a lot of money, and it will, like, it's very unlikely that this will succeed right out off the bat. On the other hand side, if you start with something that is, like, low integrated and low automated, a simple assistant solution, and try to make that fit to the threshold that you defined, having the fit of where you say, okay, like, let's say we are looking for a 10K per quarter impact, and we have an assistant solution that can get us there, maybe not, like, you know, solve the whole problem, but maybe 80% of it. Then start with this one. And this is a pattern that I see across domains, that, like, these augmented cases, which are something different than those productivity cases. Like, these augmented cases also sometimes, or very often, require you to you know, write custom prompts or compare different models, or, you know, find a setup where this works. So a custom augmented solution does not mean that everyone is just using ChatGPT. It can also be something that is integrated in your software, but it just means there's a high degree of, like, having a human in the loop at the beginning and just acknowledging that as part of a limitation or, like, ceiling of value creation that you can have. But it gets you above that threshold, and, you know, it's a win. So that's a pattern that I see, which is, like, it has been proven very successful so far.
Yeah, I think also that helps, yeah, to focus the initiatives, which, as you mentioned, is super important, yeah, to also generate value. Now let's shift our focus a little bit. You already mentioned assistant, yeah, and you describe four archetypes in the book, yeah, of AI solutions. And I think once we talked about the use cases, now I think we should talk also about the solutions. So what can companies actually do? How can they build their AI systems? And I thought this quadrant you basically mapped out is very helpful for that. Maybe you want to describe it, how you see these four archetypes?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I call it the integration automation matrix. So you can picture it as a chart. On the y-axis, you have the degree of integration, and on the x-axis, you have the degree of automation. Now, what you have then is four quadrants. The most simple one, the one that I just described, is low integration and low automation. These are simple chatbot or assistant systems, similar like ChatGPT. If you don't do anything, they don't do anything, so low automation. But they are very often also not highly integrated. It means they often work with copy-paste, and they don't live inside your systems. But you could tune that up and moving to an co-pilot type of solution, which is still not really automated. You still have to, like, you know, accept suggestions or work with suggestions, but these suggestions live inside the systems you're using every day. Like, I mean, like, perfect example for that is Copilot in Outlook, or Copilot in Excel, or Copilot in Microsoft Word or PowerPoint or whatsoever. So, and these Copilots pop up in every, like, enterprise tool that you're using these days. But they really have the purpose or the benefit that you have much less copy paste. So for example, Copilot and Outlook knows your conversation history, so you can ask for, hey, you know, when did I message Michael the last time, and we'll come up with an answer to that, and you don't have to like copy paste everything into ChatGPT. So this is pretty cool, and this is the Copilot quadrant. And both of them are like augmented use cases. The assistant and the Copilot are both augmented use case categories. And then shifting to the right side of the quadrant, there's the autopilot category, which I define as solutions that are highly automated, but they have a slightly lower integration or still low integration. Like, for example, a customer support chatbot that is living on your website. Maybe you uploaded some documents to this chatbot, or you put some FAQs behind that, or maybe that chatbot is scraping your website. Like all these things are kind of like integrated, but it doesn't live deeply nested inside your infrastructure and inside your organization. Still, it can be super valuable because, this has like less human in the loop and a higher degree of automation. And then finally, the holy grail of high integration and high automation, this is what I describe as agentic systems, AI systems that are more like driven towards reaching a goal, no matter how, that's how they figure it out by themselves. And for that to work, they need to be highly integrated and highly automated. So they need to have connectivity to different data sources, to different systems in your organization, and also run by themselves. A good example for that would be a chatbot that lives on your website and can't just answer like simple questions, but also is able to do maybe a password reset or lock a user in into different systems, or do a purchase refund and all these things. So this would be an example of an agent which is highly integrated, highly automated. Because in order to do these things, it has to have a connection to these systems. And these are basically the four archetypes that I see. I haven't really seen any use case that does not fit into any of those four big patterns or big categories. And I think it helps to look at your use cases through this lens, because if you look at your use case backlog and you find, oh, everything is an agent, then maybe it makes sense to wonder what could be a less sophisticated solution. Can we go with an 80% solution that is already creating value for us? Because the 80% solution maybe just costs 10 or 20% of the whole budget that this, supposedly 100% solution would cost you. And this is kind of the trade-off that you make. Going into these highly integrated, highly automated solution, of course, it's super cool, but it's also very, very expensive in many domains. Not really because of the AI, but just because of the whole upfront work and stuff that you have to put around that in order to make it work. This is the framework essentially, and I found that really useful so far.
Yeah, it definitely helps. It also helps, by the way, to understand agents better. So. Especially for structuring initiatives, for structuring problems and use cases, I think it's also super helpful. And I think you already mentioned a recommendation. You said it's often more helpful to start with the simpler ones, like the assistants, instead of starting with agents. Is it like a general rule or a recommendation?
Yeah. I would start with the simplest archetype possible that still crosses your threshold. Mm-hmm. So if you can, let's take the customer support chatbot example, right? You have to run this on autopilot. There's no way you can put a chatbot online and there's a human in the loop. It has to do this automatically. But it's definitely possible to have the FAQ chatbot online compared to the chatbot that can authenticate users and do a lot of other fancy stuff with them. If you have that use case on your backlog, the agentic support chatbot, I would always wonder, why can't we just build the first Q&A chatbot first? That would give us so many data points, are people actually interacting with that? What kind of questions are coming in and so on? Also helps to justify higher investment. But also, looking at internal use cases, in many cases, it makes a lot of sense just to start with a very simple assistant. It could be something custom GPT or, a custom Copilot and Copilot Studio or a Gem and Gemini, whatever that is. But just giving people, ordinary users, just a little bit more structure and guidance on, how to use that model without needing to insert prompts or uploading files there or doing all of these heavy lifting works by themselves. And then in my experience, a lot of them are very, very okay with copying results out of that tool, right? If they have at least a little bit support at the beginning. So yeah, like no, I would always prefer the simpler solution first, and then draw a path to what do we need to learn in order to like move one level higher up to like either integrate it more or to automate it more. Once we have proven that, for example, people are actually interacting with it, or proven that the AI works, which is also not always the case.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I think super helpful. And I think that sets a very good foundation to selecting the use case. In your book, you also have a chapter on rolling it out, like setting sail is the name, meaning, yeah, you have something in for how to build prototypes, how to scale it across the enterprise. That would probably be enough stuff for a whole episode of this podcast. But maybe like in 2-3 minutes, maybe you could give us a bit of an overview, like your core recommendations in like implementing AI.
So the first main step in implementing an AI is actually making the transition to implementation or to scaling a deliberate choice. Because otherwise, you will just stumble into it and find yourself like having scaled a solution or implemented a solution that was actually never meant to be shown to like, you know, more than 5 users. So what I also describe in my book is differentiating between 2 phases. The first one is the discovery phase, and the second one is the delivery phase. And by the end of the discovery phase, you need to cross a few checkpoints. One checkpoint is that you have documented the value. Like, you know, there's some value demonstration that you can show, right? Either in monetary terms or in like other terms, depending on what kind of use case category you're in, or that you have the leadership support for that, that you have user acceptance, that you have understood the path to integration, that you have the technical setup for this. So, and once you have these like foundations in place where you cross those checks, then it makes sense to move into delivery. But when you move into delivery, it also requires you to have a different mindset on how to work with these projects, because in discovery, you wanted to move fast, at least like ideally have no process overhead at all, you know, just have like 2 pizza rule team, like 2 to 5 people iterating really quickly, building prototypes, figuring out what works. But then when it moves to discovery, you need like the building blocks around that, like proper monitoring, governance, this whole, like the whole technology stack needs to be like scalable in a way that it can cater to more users or more intense usage. And just being aware of when is it time to make that step to production, I think this is really important, because this requires you to ask for more resources. But in order to make that ask, you also have something to show. Like you need to have something to show, some value demonstration or some things that you can rely on. Otherwise, the chance that your prototype will fail is really high. So you can't just launch something in solution in production and say, oh yeah, it will get better over time. Or what I hear really often is, oh yeah, the AI will figure it out over time. And it's just, that's not how it works, right? So it has to work at least on a minimal set of requirements out of the, like in the prototyping stage or in the proof of concept stage or in the pilot, whatever you want to call that, before you launch it into production. Of course, it might get better from there, but you can't rely on future value creation. The value creation has already needs already to have happened.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you a completely different question, since we're getting to the end of our episode here. There is this infamous MIT study, yeah, with this number of 5%. But now I want to know what's your experience, because I cannot confirm. Yeah, if you look at companies at the data festival that are presenting, if you look at companies or other events, if you look at our customers, yeah, where we see hands-on that, and there are definitely successful use cases, and they are delivering ROI. Maybe or often it's really hard to measure it, but you can see there is ROI. What's your experience? Yeah, so what would you say is like the percentage of successful projects that your customers run, if that's a measure? Or do you agree in general that most, by far, the message was here, by far the most use cases are not delivering ROI, the message from this study? And I would not really confirm, maybe it's not yet that they cannot deliver, maybe it cannot be measured, but they are delivering. What's your take on this big discussion?
Okay, so 2 things. The first thing is, yes, there are a lot of use cases that are not delivering ROI, mm-hmm. because the investment was too high. Like there is value creation, but they went in with too much expectations were too high, and also the investment was too big. Like, for example, to build a customer support chatbot or, you know, whatever Gen AI system you want to build, there's always a spectrum. You can build a solution for, you know, 10,000 euros or for 100,000 euros or for 10 million euros. In the end, it will be very hard to, you know, judge for like a business domain expert that has not been working on AI for the past years whether this investment was justified. You know, because some people will tell them, oh, we need to train your custom model and, you know, I don't know what. And in the end, you realize, you know, okay, all they did was just a bit of prompting. So there is this, like, you know, super high expectations where companies invest a lot of money. They get a return, but the return is not enough to justify the investment, which I would just call, you know, that's just a wrong allocation of money. But the value creation is there, but it could have been much more efficient. That's part one. And the other part is that I would say a lot of, or definitely 95% of the AI experiments are not working. And this is okay, mm-hmm. because you don't have to mix up this discovery and the delivery phase. Like the classical mistake that I see is that companies get obsessed or, you know, invested into one use case and they say, oh yeah, like, you know, we're doing this. And just, you know, to make up one example, you know, this is not related to any client or so, but, you know, it's been a big topic from the insurance industry, for example, automated claims handling, right? You know, you can use that for any insurance company out there. You know, if I could just like give my claims to the insurance and AI would figure out if it's correct or not and whatever. I mean, it sounds great on paper, right? And if you pitch this idea to an executive, you know, probably if you pitch it the right way, they happily spend 10 million on that project. But I can tell you, like, the risk of not seeing that 10 million back is like by 95%. So if you approach a project that way, the risk of, you know, failure is super high because just of all the inherent like complexities and risks that AI projects have. You know, there's like, I mean, AI projects in the end, what are they? They are IT projects which have, I think the number was about 60% or 70% of IT projects that are not meeting expectations because they take longer than expected or are getting, like, you know, more costly and so on. And now we take those IT projects, we put data on top, and then we put algorithms on top, and we expect it to somehow get easier. Well, it doesn't get easier, right? So there's this inherent complexity involved, which means whatever you try out, well, you can make an educated guess how well it works. But in the end, you have to try it out to see if it works. And that's where you need to limit the amount of investment you make into one particular case until you prove that it works. And this is, I think, where the big mismatch happens. If you, you know, fall in love with one use case and you put a lot of money into it and it doesn't work, you have the sunk cost fallacy, you put even more money into it. And like, and this is where AI projects behave differently to IT projects. Like in classical IT projects, like, you can almost do anything if you just throw enough developer hours at it. But with AI projects, you reach a certain point where you can throw more money at it and more money at it and more money at it. But if it doesn't work. And you have to, that's why, like, my philosophy is really, like, to introduce something that I call a cost cap in these projects where you say, okay, if we are not able to get a certain outcome with this amount of investment, we have to move on to a different idea because there are so many opportunity costs involved and you can't get too much invested into those cases. And I think this is what happened. I don't see this like happening so much anymore because like people have learned, but this is what I have seen, like, you know, especially in the first month or in the first year after ChatGPT launched, where, you know, people got overexcited and said, "Oh yeah, that's what we're gonna build. Like we're gonna do this." Very similar, for example, the like second brain or the organizational brain, like all these use cases. It turned out that building an organizational brain, even with ChatGPT technology, is still incredibly hard. Like you can do that, but that's nothing that you pull off in a, you know, 4-month project. Like it takes a lot of work. And if you don't really have a good business case around that and your only value creation story is, oh yeah, people will find their files faster. Well, I don't know if that is enough if you spend, you know, a 2-digit million amount on that. So yeah, and I think like this is the match that needs to happen. And this match needs to be found in the discovery phase. Only if you have found that match, you know, in a product system, you would call it product market fit, right? You have to find the solution and the budget and feasibility fit in the discovery phase. And only if you have that, you can then put it into production because then, you know, if you scale it up, it will actually stay profitable.
Yeah, very helpful. Tobias, as usual, it was a pleasure and great advice, great content. We make sure we have a link to your new book in the comments, in the show notes. But to finish it off, just one question. if there's one thing I should do as an AI project manager or as a company that wants to implement AI, one thing, what would that be?
Get the book, of course. And always start from the end. Always start from the end. So forget the AI technology, train for a little, for a short while, and just imagine, like, how would the end result look like, and how would you measure it? How would you realize that this end result has actually happened? And then work backwards from there. Like, what is getting in the way right now? What are the friction points? And then those friction points become your leverage to identify whether AI can actually help to reduce those friction points, like by speeding things up, making them cheaper, making them more scalable, and so on, or not. And I think this is like just a good mindset to have to work backwards from the end, especially for 2026 onwards.
All right. Excellent. Thanks a lot, Tobias. And I can also say, see you soon.
Yeah, thank you.